The diet that we have has a lot to do with the kinds of diseases that we become subject to. So today I'd like to talk with you about how disease is associated with the diet. The first thing I'd like to talk about is that of sleep. Now, some of you know that if you eat in a certain way, it makes you get sleepy. Some of you also know that if you eat in another way, it robs you of sleep. Something like coffee will rob many people of sleep for quite a long time. Pepper will do the same thing to some people. Salt, on the other hand, will suppress the activity that we have. It sort of dulls the mind. It makes us a little bit confused and dull. And therefore, salt, too much salt, can make a difference in the way that we are able to sleep. We need to recognize this association between disease, the presence of disease in the body, and the way that we eat so that we can take care of ourselves. We're living in a most solemn and awful moment in Earth's history, and not a soul whose life is one of careless self-degradation through transgression of physical law will stand in the great day of trial just before us. There is a terrible account to be rendered to God by those who have had but little regard for the human body and treat it ruthlessly. If we can remember that the way that we perform in times of trial often has to do with the way that we eat. If this can be recognized, then we can take steps to correct improper eating habits. The Lord wants men who will lay their hand upon a wrong work and say, "This is not according to God's will." And when we understand this in the realm of our physical bodies, it can help us to see just what is not good for us. And no one can tell another person exactly what to do or what not to do, because what may be perfectly all right for one person may be poison or an improper thing for another person. But once you understand whether something is not good for you or is good for you, then your course should be clear. You should not willingly violate that you have recognized not to be the best in your own experience. Proverbs 26, verse 2 says, "The curse causeless shall not come." In Deuteronomy 28, verses 58 to 62, and also in Leviticus 26, verses 40 to 46, we find that curses come upon those who break natural law. We have been established on the earth in accordance to natural law. And as we understand the relationships between law and the way that we function, or law and the way that we feel, or law and the development of disease, we can then come to the conclusion that when we are sick, a law has been broken. Now, much of the time, the law that has been broken has been we have ourselves been engaged in the breaking of that law. But sometimes a law has been broken back in our past history, in our family history. Now, if a law has been broken by your parents or any of your forebears, you are not yourself guilty of breaking that law. But nevertheless, you may be the subject of that law's having been broken. Many of us have certain diseases that are innate in our family line that have been passed down for generations. Some of us have a likelihood of getting diabetes. Some have a likelihood of getting heart disease or high blood pressure. Some have certain types of familial anemias. Somewhere along the line of our families, a law was broken. We may not have been involved in it at all. In fact, the first person may not have been directly himself guilty of having broken the law, but some circumstance may have, or some accident may have been at fault that caused the broken law. But whatever it is that makes us sick, we can know that law has been broken, because our Heavenly Father designed us so that we would have no flaws. No physical flaws, no emotional, mental, or moral flaws. So our frames, our selves, the unit that we represent can function perfectly according to the law that God has established in us. Now, I'd like to talk with you first about this matter of sleep. Some people find it very easy to sleep. Some find it very difficult to sleep. And I would like to tell you that correct sleep is important for you. Some of us need more sleep than others. Generally speaking, men need more sleep than women do. Now, ladies may feel, well, that's unfair. But actually, it isn't. If your husband needs more sleep, don't feel oppressed or as if you have been the subject of an ill fate. Simply recognize that he may need a little more sleep than you do. Men, do not feel that this gives you license to loll in bed all day. You probably will only need 20 to 30 minutes more sleep than your wife does. But while she gets breakfast started, you can sleep those extra few minutes if you need it. Now, in some families, it's just the reverse. There are some ladies who need more sleep than men, especially is this true in the early years of child rearing. A woman may need a good bit more sleep than her husband does at that time. And therefore, if someone has to get up at night to take care of the children, it should be father. If the baby needs to be fed during the night, father gets up, brings the baby to mother, and she feeds the baby in bed while they both lie in bed. Now, with breastfeeding, this isn't difficult at all with a little attention to techniques. And baby and mother are both happy because the next day, mother can deal with the little irritations and problems of childhood with a fresh, clear mind and with energy and enthusiasm. Of course, this doesn't last forever. This is short-lived, and at the time that the mother has recovered from the physical rigors of childbearing, she is again vigorous and strong and can take her share of nighttime duty. Essentially, twice as much benefit comes from sleeping before the hours of midnight than after. Now, one of the reasons for that, apparently, is that of the production of growth hormone. Growth hormone is produced by the pituitary, but only during sleep in adults, and that only during nighttime sleep. If you take a nap during the daytime, it is unlikely that you will get as much benefit from that nap during the daytime that you would get from sleep taken at night. People who are night workers do not live quite so long by a factor of about 5 years than those who work in the daytime. I feel that if a person is going to have to work at night, it is better that he work when he is young than after he gets a little older, that is, in his young adult life, such as from age 20 to about age 40. Then about that time, you should start working yourself out of nighttime duty if there is any way you can do so. And the way to do that is stop working on swing shifts. Now, that certainly is the worst one possible. A swing shift is the kind of thing, this week you work one set of hours, next week you work another set of hours, and the next week you work another set of hours. That is the worst of all. If you have to work at night, it is better for it to be a constant thing for you rather than in a swing shift type of thing. The body can adjust to some degree to nighttime work. But we have our enzyme and hormone systems to come out in a bell shape for their production during the day. And about the best that a nighttime worker can do is to flatten out that curve. He can never reverse that bell curve. And, of course, that means that there are certain enzymes and hormones that he simply will not get the benefit from. There are some hormones that make us cheerful, make us efficient mentally, give us a better ability to repair ourselves. And with the assistance of these hormones, we can live longer. We can function more efficiently. So we recommend that you start trying to just work in the daytime, not have nighttime work. People do get sick at night, however, and there are some industries that must work at night. If you are in one of those, then try to get to the point where you can do some kind of daytime work instead. Now, it is, generally speaking, it is better to aim at around 7 to 8 hours as a sleep time. And it may be that 7 hours are a little better for us than 8, just generally speaking, especially is this true after the age of about 40 years. Before that, we may need 8 hours, and before age 15, we may need 9, even though the individual may have reached full adult stature. Now, some studies that have been done show that people who sleep less than 9 hours, less than 6 hours, or more than 9 hours, tend to have shorter lifespans than those who sleep about 7 to 8 hours. Now, what about the kind of food that you eat and sleep? I have here a reprint from Science. This is volume 218 for December 17, 1982. The topic is Food Affects Human Behavior. Research on whether food and nutrition affect human behavior is gaining serious attention these days, so states Science. Let me just read a few sentences. The effects of nutrients on human behavior are subtle. That means it won't cause cleft palate, perhaps, and it won't cause you to get sick and be in danger of dying. That is in many instances. It may not cause you to become incapacitated mentally or morally, although there is more and more research these days indicating that there are more serious than we had previously thought effects on human behavior. Now, listen to this. Half a dozen nutrients that we know can alter the synthesis of neurotransmitters. And these neurotransmitters are serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, acetylcholine, histamine, and glycine. Now, these neurotransmitters are those chemicals that we use to transmit impulses across the junctions between two nerves. So the impulse, let us say, is going in this direction. This first nerve puts out a neurotransmitter. This neurotransmitter is then available not only to send the electrical impulse across the two nerves, but the neurotransmitter is also available to be taken up in the bloodstream to some degree. The neurotransmitter then goes all over the body and influences your behavior, influences your general health, and can even influence your emotions and the way that you think. In fact, some of these neurotransmitters can cause you to blush or blanch or get tight in the stomach or a number of other generalized reactions of which you're all familiar. These neurotransmitters are precursor dependent. What do you think precursor dependent would mean? What is a precursor? Something that goes before. So if a neurotransmitter is precursor dependent, that means that there must be a chemical in your body beforehand so that you can make this neurotransmitter just at the instant that you need to have the impulse transmitted across the junction between two nerves. What do you suppose these precursor materials are? Where do they come from? They come from nutrients that we eat, precisely. The rate at which brain enzymes synthesize the transmitters is limited by the availability of precursors that derive from food and are transported to the brain by carrier molecules. In other words, we must have a carrier chemical. The carrier chemical will put piggyback on its own chemical structure, the precursor material. It is then transported to the brain. The brain takes the precursor material from the carrier. Through a system of enzymatic reactions, it is transformed into a transmitter substance, a neurohormone or a neurotransmitter. These neurotransmitters then are available to help you to think, to walk, to make heat, to digest your food, every other thing that you ever do. Now, let us understand another thing about both the carrier as well as the precursor substance. Serotonin, one of the brain neurotransmitters that I just mentioned, serotonin is directly made from tryptophan. What is tryptophan? An amino acid. What are amino acids? Substances that make protein. The body's only source of this amino acid is dietary protein. Now, from what we have said so far, wouldn't you think that it would be nice then if we just ate a lot of protein all the time, especially that's high in tryptophan? That would solve all our needs, wouldn't it? And I'm sure that you know from the way that I'm presenting this that a lot of protein is not the answer. Let us read further. The carrier molecule that transports tryptophan transports 8 other amino acids as well. The 9 amino acids compete for the carrier. It's like going up to a ferry and there are only 9 places, or maybe there are only 8 places, but there are 9 cars to get on. Who is going to be left behind? Well, it may be tryptophan. We don't want tryptophan to be left behind, however. Let's read another step. The more tryptophan in the blood relative to the other competing amino acids, the more tryptophan enters the brain and the more serotonin is made. High protein meals do not increase brain serotonin because they do not increase the relative amount of tryptophan in the blood. High carbohydrate meals, however, do. After a high carbohydrate meal is eaten, insulin is released, and this hormone facilitates the uptake into body tissues of all competing amino acids except tryptophan, and leaves then tryptophan high in the blood. So how then would you get more serotonin? High carbohydrate meals. Of all the foods that the Lord made for us, which nutrient, so far as the fuel nutrients are concerned, which one did he make in the greatest abundance? Carbohydrates. They are in abundance in fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. They are not in abundance in any other foods. Therefore, it should be clear to us that those foods that would give us the best functioning could be obtained from fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. It just stands to reason that our divine designer made would certainly be that kind of food that would be the best to take care of all of our various body needs. Now there are some ways that you can increase the ability that you have to sleep, other than that of having to do with food, but I would like to mention just a few of these things. Number one is that of vigorous exercise, and preferably in the soil. The closer you get to the earth, the better it is. One of the old doctors used to send his patient and nurse down to the garden. When they got down to the garden, they would take off their shoes and stockings, and then they would hoe in the garden barefoot. Now, I don't know if it's necessary for us to get that close to the soil, but certainly if we have our hands and our feet on the ground at times, this certainly is better for us. The people over in Europe are working a good bit with electricity and how the earth has a certain electrical charge and how the air has certain negative air ions in it that make a difference in the way that we feel, the way that we heal, the way that we can function. We know that the negative air ions have to do with such things as depression, emotional depression. Also has to do with the way that we can develop muscles if we're in an exercise program. So that with the knowledge of these things about the electrical atmosphere and the electrical charge of the earth, there may be something there that might help us. Whatever that is, I know for a fact that if you exercise out of doors, you get 10 times more benefit than you do if you exercise indoors using some kind of gymnasium equipment. And it is a fact that the negative air ions, the beneficial kinds, are 10 times more numerous out of doors than they are indoors. Carpets and furniture and people take up the negative air ions indoors, and we lose quite a great deal from that absorption. Then another thing that you should remember about getting good sleep is to have no new activity late in the day. If at about 8 o'clock at night you start making a dress or building some shelves, it isn't likely that at 9 you're going to be able to turn that activity off in the mind, get dressed for bed, and get in bed and go to sleep easily. So wait until the next day, or start the project early enough in the afternoon that you can get a little wound down on it by the time bedtime comes around. Next thing is, if you all have an evening ritual, this will help quite a great deal. The ritual can be something like this. Family worship, study hall, have a prayer with the children, say goodnight, turn out the light, and everybody goes to bed. Now, lights do have switches on them. If you turn off the switch, it is quite likely that you will be in a better position to go to sleep. There are some people who can sleep with the lights on, but generally speaking, the whole family would be better off going to bed together. 8 or 9 o'clock, if you have small children, then parents can get up early in the morning, do the household chores early in the morning rather than late at night after the children have gone to bed at night. It's better to do your work in the morning than at night, the kind of busy work that we have to do. It is also better for children if everybody goes to bed at one time. Perhaps you've heard of the book called The Family Bed. Have you heard of that? The Family Bed. Well, there are some things in that book that are rather interesting to read. I remember in my childhood growing up in a rural area in South Georgia where all of us went to bed at the same time. My parents, my brother and I, we all went to bed at the same time. Lights were all turned out. House got quiet at one time. My parents were up at a very early hour. I never knew when they got up. But we all went to bed at the same time. That was certainly a peaceful type of thing. Everybody getting ready for bed. And I knew there was no other activity that I needed to be involved in after I got in bed. That was also a peace-giving matter as well. I recommend that for people who have children for whom there is some little problem. The parents should be with the children all of their waking hours. You should be aware of what they're doing. There are times when children develop really serious habits because of the fact that the parents send them to bed too early, send them to bed before they are ready to go to bed, and they are not supervised for half an hour to an hour before they go to sleep. And sometimes, especially if children sleep in the same bed, they may develop habits and practices that are certainly unwanted. Now, the next thing that you should recognize is to take no evening meals or snacks. While you may sleep the sleep of the dead, and sometimes it is recommended to people that they take warm milk or some other warm thing just before going to bed. Let me urge you not to do that kind of thing, as it is very destructive to the peace of your digestive tract. And the next day, you may wake up having slept several hours, 8 or 9 hours. But the next morning, you will wake up not feeling as refreshed as you would have if you had slept half that long without the milk. Avoid stimulants, television, radio, and I'm sure the new video games and all of this kind of thing that could be watched before bedtime seem to stimulate the nervous system and make it so that the sleep is interfered with. Be well hydrated, get plenty of fresh air. The brain works on these things. And sleep is a positive action of the brain. It is not absence of action in the brain. And in order for us to get a good night of sleep, we need to have the brain functioning in the very best possible way. Don't forget to have a comfortable bed and to be warm at night. Many people are aroused by restless legs. Restless legs, in my experience, have been more involved with a sensitivity to caffeinated beverages, coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate, than any other thing. Restless legs, because the person moves the legs a little bit in order to try to get them comfortable. Restless legs then arouse the individual, and finally they wake up and can't go back to sleep because they can't keep the legs still long enough to go back to sleep. Cramps in the legs may do the very same thing. A little chilling of the feet and legs because of a drop in body temperature may be the very thing involved in cramps at night. An exercise against the wall, measuring back from the wall 2 feet, putting your toes on the 2 foot line, and then leaning your chest right against the wall, holding that for 10 seconds, pushing away from the wall for 5, going back into the wall for another 10 seconds, back for 5, repeating that the third time, keeping the feet flat on the floor. This will usually abolish leg cramps. Leg cramps often interfere with the sleep, especially of older people and pregnant ladies who have difficulties with the overstretching of the muscles. Catnip or hops tea can be taken. This helps a lot of people to sleep. Also, it isn't difficult to see that 40 or 50 deep breaths would also be beneficial to a person. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk with you about that has to do with behavior and comfort and happiness in life is that of arthritis. Arthritis causes many people to have a problem. There is an emotional component for many people who have arthritis. And what this emotional component is, we don't always know. It is certain that there are some people who have a difficulty with the kind of thing that leaves bitterness in the mind. Now, bitterness in the mind can sometimes sort of settle in the bones. An old physician friend of mine who had had about 30 years of practice in the healing arts told me one time that he believed that arthritis was hate settled in the bones. Well, that's a rather interesting way to state it, but modern research does show that there are emotional factors involved in many cases of arthritis. So these should be resolved. The individual who has emotional problems or some bitterness in the life should resolve these emotional problems. So, and go to the Lord and ask the Lord to help you to find ways to ferret out little things that make up the person bitter in his heart. Another thing that can influence arthritis is that of the state of the digestive tract. The digestive tract is involved in the health of all body structures, and certain structures about the joints and around the tendons and the like can apparently attach certain parts of foods that we eat, certain nutrients, and hold these nutrients or these irritants in the joints or in the tendons around the joints in such a way as to cause pain. In Europe and from Rutgers University in this country has come some work, some research on the nightshades. Now, the nightshades are tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant, and peppers. In many quarters, it is being understood that there are a lot of people who are sensitive to the nightshades. Now, the nightshades have solanine in them and a number of other alkaloids. These alkaloids are capable of causing at least a sensitivity, if not a direct irritant effect, by this mechanism that I mentioned of attaching to joint structures. Dr. Norman Childers of Rutgers University, a horticulturist, has done a lot of work with the nightshades and the nightshade-sensitive arthritis, And he has found that from 10 to 50% of individuals in a given population may have a problem with the nightshades. We had a lady who was taking care of a 92-year-old woman who had been in a wheelchair for about 8 years with crippling arthritis. She had joint deformities that were fixed. They were constant. She had a lot of pain, a lot of swelling, and a lot of stiffness in her joints, even those that had not been deformed by the arthritis. The lady who was taking care of her removed nightshades from her diet, and within 2 weeks, her pain had gone away. Now, this didn't abolish the deformities that she had, but she did not have any more pain. She got so that she could feed herself a little bit. 2 weeks after that, her stiffness went away. And although she had been in a wheelchair for 8 years and was certainly not spry, even so, even though she had gotten over her stiffness, she at least could help dress herself and could get herself in and out of bed and go to the bathroom by herself. And so with that improvement, after only a month, the family were encouraged to continue the nightshade-free diet, and she has been on that for quite some time. This is one of the positive things that we can say to you. We know that some people who have arthritis will respond to. It is always well worth a trial to simply take people off nightshade. It costs nothing. Do it for about a month to 3 months. Some people do not get over their nightshade sensitivity promptly, and you need to leave off the nightshades for at least 3 months. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk with you about is that of the menopause. Menopause is a very interesting syndrome. Menopause is connected with the way that we live in some fashion, but we have not entirely figured out how that is. I believe that exercise has a lot to do with whether or not a woman will suffer much from menopausal symptoms. Now, this suffering that women do with the menopausal syndrome can be somewhat ameliorated by certain things that she can do. One thing is the kind of diet that she takes. And I would like to review for you this matter of how diet can affect the body of a woman by this chart that I have drawn on the blackboard. Would you just take a look at that, please? Here we have the baseline right here, and then we have this line that represents the functioning of the hormones in a monthly cyclic way in an average woman's body. Just before the menstrual period begins, day one of the cycle, we have a fall off of the hormones in the blood, the female hormones. But then with day one, there is a slight rise so that by day five, the level has risen to the point that there is sufficient support to the endometrium to make it so that the endometrium is growing back again. Bleeding stops at that time. The thing that has caused the bleeding is the fall off of the hormones, which has knocked the supports out from under the endometrium, and it bleeds. So with the recovery of the endometrium, with the rise in the hormones, the bleeding stops. Then at day 14, there is a further rise because of the hormones added from the ovaries, and then a plateau is reached. This plateau is maintained till day 25. At day 25, there is a sudden drop-off. 3 days later, a woman will have a menstrual period because, again, of the loss of the hormone support to the endometrium, the lining of the uterus. Then this cycle begins over again, and this continues throughout her reproductive lifetime. Now, this line, this wavy line, represents the steady hormone level of a menopausal woman. We decided a number of years ago that we would test to see if we could alter this line. So we took the plant sterols. These are phytosterol, cytosterol, and so forth. We took all of those foods that were high in the plant sterols out of the diet of a lady who was 5 years postmenopausal, who had not had any bleeding at all. We did that all in one day, and sure enough, 3 days later, she had a mini menstrual period right here. The first time she had had any bleeding at all in 5 years. We felt quite convinced that with this small experiment that we could alter the hormone levels, the general hormone levels of steroidal substances, some of which are like estrogens, but some of which are like the plant sterols. So we began to experiment with ladies who were having menopausal symptoms by simply giving them a diet very high in the plant sterols. And you will see a list of that in our book, Nutrition for Vegetarians, on page 49, a list of those foods high in plant sterols. The diet is not a bad one. Let me just give you some of the foods that are involved. Apples, cherries, olives, plums, carrots, yams, beans, peanuts, soy products, the nightshades. Now, while the nightshades might not be good for a person with arthritis, they are good for a person with the menopause symptoms. That is, if she doesn't have arthritis or an arthritis sensitive to the nightshade. So they are high in the plant sterols. All of the grains, with the exception of rye and the white products, all of the white products are low in plant sterols. And I believe this is one of the important reasons why we have so many women in the United States with menopausal symptoms, because of the fact we use so much white rice, white spaghetti, white macaroni, white starch, and so forth, which are all low in the plant sterols. Because of the fact that our food is so low in the plant sterols, it could be that the ovaries must overproduce, and having done so for many, many years, then at the time of the menopause, they do not function as well as they could have if we had not used the polished grains or the refined grains. Buckwheat is also low in plant sterols, but buckwheat is not a grain. Buckwheat is a seed, but it is a seed of a little plant, not one of the grasses. A variety of herbs are also high in plant sterols. This would include alfalfa, aniseed, garlic, licorice root, parsley, red raspberry, sage, oregano, and some others. Then there are some other foods that don't fit well in any other category. Food yeast is one of those high in the plant sterols. Wheat germ is also high, and coconut, all of these. Now, we recommend for the woman who has menopausal symptoms that, first of all, she recognize that she needs to change her diet. Then the second thing is that she recognize she needs a change in her daily lifestyle. Get out of doors, get plenty of exercise. Now, the exercise that a woman needs who is postmenopausal or menopausal may be 3 to 5 hours of outdoor labor. Now, if she starts right away with a hoe and a shovel and a wheelbarrow and other very heavy implements doing very heavy labor, is that likely to go over very well? Not very well, not for a woman who has been sedentary for 15 or 20 years. So what she needs to do is to take a small project at first, a little hoeing, a little transplanting of some flowers, small flowers. Then as time goes by, she can get to transplanting shrubs, small shrubs, and then pretty soon she'll be able to dig ditches or clean out the driveway, the ditches of the driveways, or whatever other thing she might want to do in the way of physical exercise. A walking program is also very good for a woman, and you can get progressive walking programs. Here is one for a lady who is age 50 to 59. The first 2 weeks, she could walk 1 mile a day. That is, if she is in every way healthy. She should take about 17 minutes. She should do that no less than 5 times a week. Then weeks 3 to 4, she could walk a mile and a half. If this is for a woman who has not been having exercise. She should walk a mile and a half in 24 minutes, 5 days a week at least. The weeks 5 and 6, 2 miles, taking only 31 minutes to walk 2 miles. Weeks 7 to 8, 2.5 miles, taking only 38 minutes to walk the 2.5 miles. Then weeks 9 to 10, 3 miles, taking no more than 45 minutes to walk those 3 miles. And then after she has gotten up to 3 miles, she can increase the distance that she walks and reduce the time required to walk each mile, just week by week, until she reaches the best distance and best time for herself. Now, a woman who will do this will find that she can right away begin to reap the benefits of a sense of well-being. Another thing that menopausal women should beware of is that of too much salt. Too much salt can make a little swelling of the fingernails and around the fingernails, and a woman feels that her fingers are puffy. She feels that her feet are puffy, and salt can cause a problem in this regard. And I would like to mention, since we are on the subject of salt, that a number of behavioral problems or disorders that have a behavioral component can be associated with salt. We have had several cases of migraine headache that stopped the migraines immediately by the only measure being that of removing salt from the diet. The premenstrual syndrome can be greatly influenced by removing salt from the diet. And here is one written in October of 1984 in The Lancet, which is a very prestigious medical journal. It's about salt, postulating salt in the formation of peptic ulcers of the stomach. And I wouldn't doubt it at all. This investigator feels that he has shown that salt is probably involved or possibly involved in both strokes and stomach ulcers. Now, one of the big problems that women have during the menopause is that of a fear of osteoporosis, and I do state it just that way. Most women do not have osteoporosis if they work at their diet and lifestyle in a proper way. Let me just read to you some of the causes of osteoporosis. Alcohol, the use of steroids, that would be cortisone, prednisone, and things like that, a high uric acid. And where do we get a high uric acid? From eating animal products mainly, especially meat and organ meats at that. Pancreatic disease can cause osteoporosis. By the way, what is osteoporosis? A thinning of the bones. That's right, a reduction in mineral. Liver disease. Birth control pills. And a number of diseases that are sort of rare, like Gaucher's disease and Caisson's disease. Then if a woman gets a fractured bone, the immobilization of that bone can cause osteoporosis. Smoking causes osteoporosis. Caffeinated beverages. 1 cup of coffee per day will make a woman lose 1.4% of her bone mineral past the age of 50 every single year. 1.4%. That would be 14% mineral loss of the bones in 10 years after the age of the menopause. Now, if she begins to lose the mineral, let's say at age 55, by age 65, it would be 14% less if she drinks 1 cup of coffee per day. And 10 years after that, it would be 28%, quite a significant bone mineral loss. Then thyroid supplements can also increase mineral loss from the bones. A subtotal gastrectomy, taking too much vitamins A or D, the intake of too much sodium. Now, where do we get sodium? From salt. Phosphorus or protein. Now, where do we get phosphorus? If we take too much in the way of wheat bran. Wheat bran is high in phosphorus. But what is the commonest thing that all Americans drink that is high in phosphorus? Milk. Milk is high in phosphorus, and there are some studies. Of course, you may know that the whole subject of osteoporosis is a subject surrounded by a lot of controversy these days. Some people say give lots of milk, lots of calcium substances, and or calcium supplements, and plenty of estrogenic substances. But since estrogens are known to be associated with other diseases, cancer being one of those other diseases, but there are several others as well. Mental depression is another associated with the taking of estrogens. With the taking of estrogens, other disease results, so we have felt that it would be far better if a woman would make certain that she did not take any of these substances, since milk is also now being implicated in leukemias and cancers and the like, then we recommend that the diet be controlled in the way that I have mentioned. There is also some very good research that shows that you can prevent osteoporosis by two things. Number one, a vegetarian diet. Number two, plenty of exercise. So if you get those two and will avoid coffee, avoid smoking, avoid alcohol, avoid taking steroids like cortisone and the like, don't take birth control pills, you should be able to handle things perfectly well. One other thing that I should mention is that of antacids containing aluminum. The aluminum-containing antacids bind calcium, replace calcium in the bone, and make a weakened bone. So it's important to handle things in that way. Zinc-high foods can also be a great help to the person who is in the menopause syndrome. Now, zinc-high foods would include the following. Beans, all common varieties, whole grain breads, chickpeas and or garbanzos, field corn, sweet corn. Isn't that diet good? Yes, these are very nice. This is very nice. Oatmeal, peanuts, peas, popcorn. The children will like that. And, of course, menopausal women will like that also. Now, with these, thinking about the menopausal syndrome in this way can help you to see that there are special things in the lifestyle of the individual that can control the menopausal syndrome. The last thing that I would like to talk with you about is that of thyroid disease. You might think, well, thyroid disease could only be controlled by very heavy drugs or surgery. But we have had a number of cases of underactive thyroid as well as overactive thyroid, both of which were helped by the taking of a diet of a special kind. If one has an overactive thyroid, one would take the following types of foods: cabbage, carrots, kale, peaches, peanuts with the skins on, pears, rutabaga, soybeans, spinach, strawberries, turnips. Again, not a bad diet, is it? Now, the person with an overactive thyroid would simply emphasize those foods in the diet. If you have an underactive thyroid, you would leave those foods out of your diet. Make certain that you do not take those. Now, the individual who has a low thyroid can do some other things as well. Number one is do not sleep with an electric blanket. Another is take a cool shower in the morning, a little cooler than is maintenance shower. Everyone should take a cool shower, not cold, not hot. Both of those are treatment baths, but you should take a cool shower every morning. Follow that with a brisk rub down. But the woman who is menopausal should take a very cool shower. Still, it does not need to be cold usually. And follow that by a brisk rub down, and then go out in nature and exercise vigorously. And the word concerning exercise should be vigorous, though not violent. And if you will do these things, you will find that that has been provided for us in nature will also help us with many of these rather serious disabilities and discomforts that we have come to recognize as modern society disorders. And may the Lord help us as we study ourselves and our own needs and then implement the proper kind of diet in our own lives.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.